You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Today, we're learning about a movement to change the fundamental legal priorities of our state. Currently, Oregonians do not have a constitutionally protected right to a clean and healthy environment, leaving our natural resources vulnerable to short-term interests. The Oregon Coalition for an Environmental Rights Amendment wants to change state law to prioritize protections of natural resources like land, air, and water. Joining us are two people at the forefront of this effort. Mel Martin is a campaign coordinator with OCERA. Welcome, Mel.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you.
And Dr. Alan Journay is co-facilitator of Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, or SOCAN. Welcome back to the Exchange, Alan.
Well, thanks for inviting us both. We appreciate it.
So, Mel, let's start with you. I know that many Oregonians likely assume that we have a right to a healthy environment, and it's already constitutionally protected. What's the current legal reality?
The current legal reality is that, unfortunately, the system is overly responsive to the big money interests of things. So when we're talking about the how government should work and what we're doing to change it, we're trying to reestablish what we expected as the people. You know, the government should work in the public interest, using the best available evidence, but that's unfortunately not happening. And it's not through any particular fault of anyone or any particular administration. It's really the nature of things is that the corporations and industries have a legal duty to maximize their profit and to the fullest extent of the law. And so when our laws allow for certain influences into good governance, that unfortunately yields the result that we have today. So even though we believe that the law should work in a certain way, and we also expect that we have good laws already on the books, unfortunately, the reality is it doesn't work that way.
Okay, well, there are certain healthy tensions in our society. You're describing an unhealthy tension, and your proposed amendment explicitly mentions the rights of children and future generations. Why is it so vital to prioritize long-term public health in the Constitution?
Absolutely, because, again, the reality is that it's the short-term interests that are gaining the most traction in government decisions. So that's the basic truth of the matter.
Okay. Well, Alan, your organization highlights a fire deficit and alarming temperature projections for Southern Oregon. So as we start to look into the future, there's a problem that we see looming on the horizon, and there's no protections in our Constitution. First of all, what is a fire deficit?
Well, essentially, that comes from a research project that was published in 2012, Jennifer Marlin and a bunch of researchers in forest ecology. And what they were doing was looking at the area that's burned, forested area that's burned historically in relation to climate. And what they revealed was that there's a tremendous correlation between climate, i.e. warm temperatures, dry conditions, and the area burned by fire. Excuse me. And when they looked at, I think they went back about 3,000 years, and they were looking at these trends, and they saw a tremendous correlation between climatic conditions and area burned. Mm-hmm. And what they revealed was, at the moment, according to the climatic conditions we're experiencing, that we should be having much larger area burned by fire than we're actually seeing. And that's presumably a function of our incredibly effective techniques for fire suppression. So we've been putting fires out when climatically they should be burning larger areas. And that's what the fire deficit is. Climatically, one would expect, given this correlation, that to be larger areas of Oregon and the western forests burning than it actually is the case. Indeed, when we look at data from the Oregon Department of Forestry, what we find is if we go back to the beginning of the last century, the area burned was comparable probably to that really bad year, 2020, rather than the general annual trend that we've been experiencing. And so that back then we were in a period that was warm and dry, and that was a function of what's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and we don't need to go into that. But what's been happening now over the last 30 or 40 years is global warming has superseded the impact of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation on our climate. And so we're getting conditions year after year where fire is almost inevitable.
Okay, but at the same time, we built a bunch of places to live.
Yes, we have.
We can't just let the fire continue in its natural state, just burning everything, because it'll burn the places where we have built things to live.
Exactly
and
right.
And that's why I think you have this tension between the private sector that has built things and wants to protect those things and wants to build more things, and the people who want to protect the environment and allow the natural cycles to occur.
Yeah, and that brings another question into the issue. I mean, what I was talking about was a climatically induced set of conditions that stimulate spread of fire once it's ignited. But in addition to that, we do live in this thing called a Mediterranean climate, which is winter wet, summer dry. So our climate has for millennia been a climate in which every summer soils and vegetation dry out, and so fire conditions become inevitable. And so our forests, particularly the dry forests in the western states, they've lived with fire for millennia, so they become fire-prone. Mm-hmm. Fire adapted, so the species that we have historically had in these areas are adapted to fire, and so they're fire dependent. Those communities are fire dependent. So that's the argument that leads to the environmental concern that we absolutely need to have fires in our western forests. Mm-hmm. And so putting them out as soon as there's a threat of the happening is great for the people who live there, but it's not good for the health of the forests.
Okay, so now we're talking long term.
Yes.
And so that vision brings me to Mel. In your amendment, you mentioned something called a public trust doctrine. What is that?
In the amendment, it does help to ensure that it's abundantly clear that the state is the trustee for the natural resources in Oregon. And what that means is that has public trust duties of loyalty and impartiality and prudence of how it manages the trust assets, which are the natural resources in Oregon. So it just has an inherent duty to be transparent, has the duty to be accountable to its decisions, ensuring that the public interest is served. So it's to the benefit of the people to include future generations. So we don't want to waste or take up or take away everything that future generations are going to need to not just survive but thrive. So in the amendment, it directs that to ensure that the government does what we thought it was doing the entire time, but clearly constitutionally mandated to do so for not just our own health and safety and welfare, but that of future generations.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Mel Martin, campaign coordinator for the Oregon Coalition for an Environmental Rights Amendment, and Dr. Alan Journay, co-facilitator with Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. So Mel, some of the critics worry about NIMBYism or frivolous lawsuits. How does this amendment prevent How does this amendment prevent moneyed interests from suing?
Absolutely. So that was a big consideration in the design of it. So the amendment is public interest in nature. So plaintiff would have to be able to use the amendment in the to the benefit of the public interest. So that kind of carves away NIMBYism or any sort of abuse of the amendment for private gains. It really is, you have to show first that something is happening in, you know, government action or inaction that is hurting the interests of people. In general, the health and safety and well-being of communities, of families, of neighbors, of your own family. So it's to that degree of consideration and not just, you know, someone who doesn't like to see a particular view or would have only private interests at stake.
Okay.
And that's the level. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So, Alan, to Mel's point, having this type of protection in the law actually has worked. I mean, there's some examples like in Montana
yes.
and Hawaii. Tell me about those.
Yes, an organization called Our Children's Trust, of which probably many listeners have heard, maybe not the name, but they've heard what the OCT has been doing. They have been, over the last decade or more, been serving youth who have sought to insist that states follow their constitution in terms of if their constitution includes a statement that the citizens of that or the residents of that state have a right to a healthy environment. The youth have been filing suit against the state to insist that the states indeed follow that public trust doctrine. Mm-hmm. And in the case of a couple of cases which are very notable in Montana, the state legislature passed a law which said that the state didn't have to honor its protection of the environment in the case of climate issues. And the youth filed suit against the legislature basically for passing that law, saying it was unconstitutional given the fact that the state has this statement about the right to a healthy environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the youth were successful. The judge ruled in favor of the youth and ruled that the law passed by the legislature was unconstitutional.
Because Constitution had that
That
language.
Seems to be the pattern. When the Constitution has that pattern, the youth who are filing suit are successful. And the same thing happened effectively in Hawaii, although what happened there was the Hawaii Department of Transportation saw the writing on the wall because they have such a statement in their Constitution and caved in basically to the youth and adopted policies and programs that fulfilled their obligation to their constitution.
Okay, so real quick, indigenous people have lived here for thousands of years. They didn't need this mandate in their constitution. And when the Europeans arrived here, this place was pristine. Why is that?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on indigenous culture and indigenous behavior, but just from my perspective, it seems to me that, and most people I think are probably aware of this, Native Americans have a culture in which they live two things. One is they are always living seven generations down the line, so they're always looking into the future in exactly the way that. As Mel was saying, we tend not to. And the other thing is, in a spiritual sense, if you spend any time with Native Americans, you realize that for them, they are relatives of our natural world. And so the natural world is part of them. So they have a tremendous respect for the world in which they live because of that spiritual kinship.
Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap this up because unfortunately we're out of time. But I understand that you and Mel are on a listening tour. Mel, tell me more about that really quick.
Of course. The intent is to ensure that we are getting the ground truth reality of, you know, straight from Oregonians, the truth of their experiences dealing with and experiencing these environmental harms that are, by and large, in many cases, preventable or at least can be mitigated better than they are being mitigated.
Okay, so where can people find more information about your tour?
On our website, oserauniteded.org. Okay. There's a link that will take them to the listening tour and find out more.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. We'll also put it on our website as well. Thank you both.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
First program's March the 31st.
Okay. My guests were Mel Martin, campaign coordinator for the Oregon Coalition for Environmental Rights Amendment, and Dr. Alan Journay, co-facilitator with Southern Oregon Climate Action Now.